Good morning or good evening, depending on when you're listening to this lecture. I'm going to talk today about my research on classroom talk. It's something I've been involved in for several decades, and in fact, I've been interested in the functions of talk in the classroom for a lot longer, ever since I was at school, really, since I started to appreciate that classroom education can go quite well or quite badly on a personal level. And I was intrigued by what was involved in that. I'm going to talk about two projects that I've been involved in as examples of what I've done in order to discuss some of the things that we found and also to discuss some aspects of this kind of research, which I assume is the kind of research you're involved in and that you're interested in finding out more about. So I hope it'll all be clear, and I can answer questions on this afterwards, I believe, in a session that follows up, or you can email me. I also thought I'd mention at the moment that you might also want to look at the Orosi Cambridge website, which is up on the slide there, because we've got several blogs on that site which are to do with classroom talk, and you might find them interesting by me and other people who are involved in the centre. Over the years, my colleagues and I have carried out research in two main ways. First of all, we've done some projects in which we've simply observed and analysed spoken interaction in the classroom to see if the ways talk is used relate to students' learning, to look for the patterns of that talk, and if possible, make some more general sense of the way talk is used in such settings. Secondly, we've designed particular interventions, that is, particular ways of using talk in classroom, usually on the basis of particular activities which we've created working with teachers, and then got teachers to carry them out and see whether they actually have a positive impact on the way the students work and the kind of learning that they achieve. So those are the two main ways that we've done things. Sometimes they're not completely separate. We've also usually used mixed methods in studying talk. That is, we've used both qualitative and quantitative methods. I don't really think any of us should be willing to be labelled as either a quantitative or a qualitative researcher. I think if people who are attached to one of those ways of doing research in education are very short-sighted and narrow-minded, I think what we really need to do is use the methods that best enable us to answer the particular research questions that we've designed for any particular project. And I usually find that a combination of those methods allows me to get the sort of evidence that I feel most confident about in drawing conclusions about what goes on in classrooms. And also, evidence from both methods is more likely to convince relevant audiences, such as teachers themselves, policymakers, and other researchers. We've also worked with teachers in the outcomes of our research. It's not simply a case of carrying out research and publishing it in journals and hoping somebody will find it. We've invariably arranged workshops, conference presentations and so on, and obviously worked with teacher training, in initial teacher training and CPD, to share the outcomes of our research and that of other people. Because I really do feel strongly that education research should be applied research if it's worth doing at all. And as we like to say, we don't do research on teachers, we do research with teachers. As I mentioned, I'm going to use two projects that I've been involved in as examples to discuss issues that arise. The first is really one of a series of projects called Thinking Together, in which we were really focusing on group work in primary classrooms. It was an interventional project, and we were trying to improve the quality of group work in primary classrooms. The second one was an observational project, a very recent one, in which we were really basically trying to see whether the ways that teachers talk with students makes a significant difference to the quality of the learning and the achievements of students, and also their attitudes to school. So I'll deal with each in turn. So the first project, Thinking Together in Science and Maths. The main research question was the one I wrote down there. We wanted to know if children could be taught by their teachers how to use talk more effectively when they're working together in a group, because, as I'll explain in a minute, other research had suggested they often didn't use talk as effectively as they might when they were put in that sort of group situation. We focused on science and maths partly because there was a lot of interest in children's study of those particular subjects at that time, but also because we thought the learning outcomes might be quite clear in those subjects, and it seemed a relevant focus. And children were often put in groups, especially in science, to do activities together. So what did we do? Well, on the basis of what was known from earlier research, our own and other people's, we designed a set of 12 lessons which were intended to develop children's skills in using talk to work together. And we recruited teachers and their classes from schools around the Open University in Milton Keynes to become involved in the project. Because it was an intervention project, we wanted to really see the effects of the intervention in a very clear way. So we divided those classes up into a set of intervention classes, those in which we carried out an experiment, if you like, and seven which were the control classes, in which we simply asked teachers to carry on with the group work in the way they normally did. We recorded children's talk in groups. We always use groups of three, mainly because research had suggested this is the best size of group for children to work with, especially in primary schools. And we focused on science and maths because we thought they were two subjects in which learning outcomes could probably be clearly defined. And also there was a lot of interest in children's study of those topics. We were able to get funding more easily. We focused on those particular topics. And so we recorded their talk initially before they'd been involved in the intervention in both sorts of classrooms. And then we recorded it after. In which one set, the intervention, children in the intervention classes, had in fact been involved in specific activities to develop their use of talk. The teachers carried out these activities. We didn't become directly involved with the children. They were activities we got the teachers to do, and we trained the teachers in how we thought they should be carried out. And then, of course, what we did afterwards was compare how the children talk before and after. And we also looked at the learning outcomes for both intervention and control classes. As I mentioned a minute ago, we based the intervention activities on previous research. And some of that research is research I'd been involved in myself. In a project called SLAMP, which was also carried out when I was at the OU and involved the University of East Anglia as well, we actually simply observed how children worked together when they were working up computer-based tasks in pairs and trios. This was very early times for computers to be used in classrooms. It was in the early 80s. And computers were in very short supply, so it was quite common for teachers to put more than one child at the computer because that way they'd all get a go. And this was quite convenient because it meant that computers were a focus for group work and collaborative learning, at least. So what we had done in that project was simply see what differences were happening amongst the children in these different schools, not just around Milton Keynes, but across East Anglia as well. And basically what we found, as you can follow this up if you wish, was that we really saw three kinds of talk going on. First of all, we saw the kind of talk that gives group work a bad name, which is called disputational talk, in which children don't really think together or work together very well. They sometimes get cross with each other. They just say what they think and they just stick to their own points of view. As we say there, they often say, yes, it is. No, it's not. Well, you're stupid anyway, kind of thing. And the atmosphere is competitive rather cooperative. We saw quite a lot of that going on. Another kind of talk we saw was cumulative talk, in which it was much friendlier. People did interact in a more cooperative way in one sense, in that they gave their ideas and shared them, and they seemed to listen to each other. But they simply spoke what they thought and agreed with what other people said and then went on. There wasn't really any critical interaction in the group. They were accumulating knowledge together, perhaps, but they weren't interrogating that knowledge or each other. They would repeat and elaborate each other's ideas, but they wouldn't evaluate them. There was no constructive argument. It was quite useful. It was much better than disputational talk, but it didn't really go far enough. It didn't really get to the essence of what people can do when they use talk to think critically together and reach solutions. The third talk, which we didn't see a lot of, we called exploratory talk, using Douglas Barnes's term here, in which everybody did engage critically and constructively with each other's ideas. Everybody would have some part in the group's deliberations. Everybody's ideas would be treated as worth consideration. Children would ask each other questions. They would ask for reasons and give them. So there was reasoning going on using the tool of language. Also, and importantly, they tried to reach an agreement. So they didn't just say, oh yeah, whatever you think. They tried to get to some deliberative conclusion. So the reasoning was visible in the talk. And this seemed to us the kind of talk that was most likely to achieve positive outcomes when children work together. Because it was using this wonderful tool of human language to actually achieve something which only our species can do, which is put our brains together in a sort of mega brain and think collectively. That's why we're the dominant species, for better or worse, in the world. And at the time I'm recording this lecture, there are lots of teams of people trying to think of ways of counteracting or overcoming the coronavirus. And in fact, I've been reading about it, and often it is attributable to teams of people coming up with ideas from different backgrounds, been able to put them together and come up with some sort of solution. I've yet to wait and see whether this is successful or not at the point I'm recording this talk. So this is the kind of talk which exploratory talk is useful in any kind of teamwork, not just in classrooms. It's the kind of thing that really gets things done when people have to think and really pursue joint goals and try and reach useful conclusions and solutions together. I should say that, you know, three kinds of talk, it's a fairly crude sort of distinction. And we have wondered at sometimes about whether there should be more fine-grained kind of differences. And not all talk neatly fits into any one of those boxes. You'll see some talk that's a bit cumulative, a bit exploratory, sometimes retreats into being disputational. But in the end, my view is that the three-part distinction is the most useful one for researchers. If you get any more complicated, it just gets complicated for the sake of it. And the clear distinction between what these kinds of talk represent is lost. So they're not neat categorical boxes which every kind of talk fits one or the other. They're a heuristic device for seeing the differences between the way people talk when they're working together in groups. Some of the first research I ever did in classrooms, which was with Derek Edwards and Janet Mabin, focused on teacher-student interaction. We wrote a book called Common Knowledge. And we found that one way of making sense of what went on in classrooms was to think of participants following an implicit, unwritten set of rules, which we call ground rules, using a metaphor from sport. And this was, they knew they had to behave in certain ways, even if nobody actually told them to do so. And for better or worse, they would follow these rules. So for example, a common rule in classrooms is, if a teacher asks a student a question, then there will be a correct answer and the student is meant to offer that correct answer succinctly and briefly as possible. That isn't always a good idea, but that's what most students think and most teachers seem to think it should be going on. So we call these sets of rules ground rules. When we started to look at working groups, we realised the same sort of thing applied, that children were following implicit rules, which were not always the best ones. For example, some children seem to be following rules like, well, if I know the right answer, I should keep it to myself, so I'll do better than the others. Or if I don't like the other person, I'll rubbish their ideas, whatever they say. Or if they're my friend, well, I'll always agree with them, even if there's some that they're wrong in some way. And we realised that when children worked together, they actually were using a different set of ground rules, which were the ones that generated exploratory talk. And that was, they would do things like this. They would share all relevant information, take turns and contribute, all of them. They would check understanding by asking each other questions. They would provide reasons for what they say, not just simply state ideas. They would listen to what other people said and build on it to reach a joint conclusion that was useful. And they'd try and reach an agreement in the end rather than just agreeing to differ. And when they did this, this was, as I say, the kind of talk that we called exploratory talk. And what we wanted teachers to do in the intervention was get the children to follow these kind of ground rules. And that this set of ground rules I've just put up on the slide is one that one teacher in a classroom actually used. And they would get the students, talk to them about what was good working groups and what they thought made it work well and otherwise, and then lead them into this agreement that they would follow this set of ground rules so that they would end up generating exploratory talk rather than disputational or merely cumulative talk. We can see how a teacher guides children into using exploratory talk from transcript one. This was recorded in March when they'd begun the intervention at the very beginning of that term. So they'd already got to establish the ground rules. She got them, had the discussion with them about what makes talk good in groups and what makes it difficult. And she carried out the set of 12 lessons, of which you can find some examples on the Thinking Together website, which is linked to the Orator Cambridge one. If you look at that, you'll find a link to Thinking Together, and you'll see the lessons there. So the teacher here is starting off by reminding the children, really, what they'd agreed they'd do when they worked together in groups. So she asks the children what you need to make sure the whole group has done. And Emma says, agreed. And the teacher says, yes, the whole group needs to agree. And she writes it down in a speech bubble. Then she goes on to ask what other things they might hear each other saying during the lesson. A boy says, what do you think? She says, yes, what do you think? Anything else you might hear people say? Ask Kay. Kay says, what's your idea? Brilliant. She likes that. What's your idea? Oh, Sydney, why do you think that? Excellent. Well done. Well, you can see that's a very straightforward and rather sort of traditionally exchange between teachers and students, in which the teacher clearly knows what she wants to hear from them, and she provides feedback on their answers. It's an IRF pattern, isn't it? Set of linked IRFs, initiations, response and feedback. But it does the job. Sometimes teachers should be using that kind of approach to check the understanding of students. And in this case, it's vital she does so before they set off on an activity. So that was in early March. And then we recorded the students, the children working in their groups. And as it went on later in the month, we started to see in some group discussions echoes of what the teacher had said to the children of those earlier teacher-student interactions. I've highlighted in colour some of the things that do that. You can see the same words are coming out. The children are, in fact, coming up with the same sort of words that the teacher used in their groups. It might look a bit kind of obvious and as if they're simply parroting what the teacher said, but I think this is part of the learning process where they take these words from the teacher, as Bakhtin says, we take words from other people's mouths, and they're using them functionally to work together in the group. As they went on, it starts to become less obvious that they're simply taking the actual words of the teacher and more using the same intentions as the teacher to achieve the same sort of interactions and thinking together in the group. Of course, we were recording in the control classes as well. And what we found in the control classes would typically in the group work was what we'd found in that earlier slant research where we defined the three kinds of talk. We found quite a lot of disputational talk going on and very little exploratory talk. Here's an example, transcript three, when some students were working on a science activity to do with sound insulation. And you can see there's Hannah, Daryl and Deborah here. They are interacting, they're all speaking. But it's not particularly co-constructive. They're not really thinking together. They're not, as I've put it elsewhere, they're not into thinking. Daryl really just gets a bit cross with Hannah. And Hannah simply says, oh, it's better when Stephanie's in our group. And they shout at each other a bit. Right, try it. Try what? That? Try glass. Yeah. And it doesn't really go anywhere. You get the feel of it when you hear the actual recording much more. And that unfortunately was often the case in the control classes. We were recording, as time went on, in the intervention classes too, of course. And we started to see in those classes more children using the kind of talk we would call exploratory. In other words, they were following the ground rules, even if those ground rules were less apparent in what they said. They became, if you like, more implicit, and they weren't necessarily echoing the words the teacher would use when they were discussing how they would work together. And so you can see here in transcript 4, you've got Ross, Alana and Dijek working on a science activity, this time looking at the ways that different materials act for light insulation. And they have to plan to test different types of paper in this case, as Ross explains in his first statement there. And you can see that Alana straight away asks Dijek what he thought. She asks for his views. And he gives an answer. And he uses the word because at least 10, because tissue paper is thin. He explains it in a bit more detail. In other words, he's giving a reason in response to her question. And then Alana turns to Ross and said, why do you think that? Because he's been nodding away while this has been happening. He says, because I tested it before, which she doesn't find a particularly sufficient answer. What did you think? Which she echoes the ground rules again. How much did you think? How much tissue paper did you think would be to block out the light? And he goes into some detail and she asks the why question. She wants the reason. He uses because again, and you can see that he gives a reason, which she judges in her final statement as a good reason. So you can see these children are using that kind of talk. They are interthinking. They're not just interacting. They're actually thinking collectively to try and come up with an answer which is the best one for the activity, for the question that they've been asked to pursue in this lesson. I mentioned earlier that in the Thinking Together research we used mixed methods. And one of the ways we did that was to use the results of examinations that children have been involved in to see whether the teachers who used that kind of approach, who used our intervention, actually achieved better learning outcomes for their students. And I've put up one slide here, which is the one that we put together for the SATS results, SATS science results in the intervention and control classes. And you can see there that we did find that after the intervention, the target classes, that is the intervention classes, actually had made much better improvements in their SATS science question answers, in their scores, than the control classes. So this was the kind of thing we hope to be able to use to convince policymakers as well as teachers that devoting some specific attention to improving the quality of children's talk in groups actually paid off in terms of conventional educational outcomes. Overall then, in this research, and this applies to the several projects which were associated with the Thinking Together intervention, as well as this one, we did find that children in the intervention classes used more talk which had the features that we associate with exploratory talk, the kind of interthinking talk, the way that people use talk effectively to get things done, learn together, solve problems and so on. We also found that the children in the intervention classes pursued the group activities more collaboratively and in more depth. You could see that from the quality of their discussions when we analyse those discussions qualitatively, in the way I described earlier. And they also became better at solving problems together. In other words, they were more effective at thinking together on a common problem and seeking a solution for it that they all would agree to in the end. So this is quite important in itself, because it suggested to us that people can learn to be better at working together in teams. They can learn how to use talk more effectively to get teamwork done and to pursue the common goals. And this is obviously an important aspect of human life, as well as working in a primary classroom. We all want to be able to work together effectively to solve problems, as the current coronavirus situation illustrates as well as anything. And yet there is an assumption often that either that people just know how to work together in a team or a group, or that some people are just naturally good at it and other people aren't very good at all, and that's life. I think what we showed here is that certainly people can get better, and certainly that it can be taught. You can learn how to do it. And I don't think we can expect children to learn these kind of skills naturally outside school. For some children, hearing and taking part in a reasoned discussion may be a very, very rare occurrence for them in their ordinary lives outside the classroom. So they don't get experience and training even in how to do it here in the classroom, then they're probably not going to get it at all. And that can make a big difference not only to their lives, but to those of the people that they're working with and the people they're living with. So this was pretty important as a finding, which we've backed up and other people have backed up in other ways since. But also, this was an interesting finding, we found that the students became better at solving problems alone. And that's what the SATS results I just showed you illustrate. They didn't only get better at finding the right outcomes to science and maths activities when they're working in a group. They internalised that way of working, if you like, to become better at solving problems alone. And this really supports a Vygotskian perspective on the development of intelligence and of thinking, which is that children, first of all, learn to think, as he put it, on the social plane, collectively, by being involved in collective thinking, and then they internalize that. And if you think about it, what an educated person should be able to do is have a reasoned discussion on their own, in their own head. On the one hand this, on the other hand that, have I thought of everything? What might somebody say to me who wasn't convinced by this? And so this is what really should be happening in schools and in classrooms. And it's one of the ways that we see that talk is important, not only for communicating with other people, but it becomes a tool for thinking on one's own. It structures thought. As Vygotsky again said, "What once a child acquires language, their thinking is transformed forever." So this was another interesting finding. And as I say, we could support that by showing that they got better scores in the national SATS tests. The classes actually got better scores in the formal tests at the end of the year if they'd been in the intervention group of classes. So this is the sort of thing we wanted to be able to find out. I thought I'd now sort of look at this from a rather more detached perspective and consider what are the pros and cons, the positive and negative aspects of doing this kind of interventional research in classrooms, of which the Thinking Together research is one illustrative example. And I think this may be relevant to your own interests, I hope so, when you're doing your own research. So first of all, one of the advantages of doing this kind of research is that as a researcher, you get to work very closely in partnership with teachers. You can form a team with teachers. You're working with them so that they understand the reasons why you're suggesting this intervention is worth trying. You can discuss with them ways of modifying it if it seems relevant to make it more applicable to their situation. And you can involve them directly in pursuing the research questions. You're relying on them a lot. But this is a positive thing, I think, to be able to work with teachers in this way. Secondly, the scale of this project, where you're only dealing, as you saw there, with 14 classes or something like that, makes it possible to really get in depth in the data, in the talk data. You can really afford to have any of the talk that you are interested in transcribed. It means that you can really look at it in detail. You can watch the videos over and over. We would typically watch them as a group, as a team, not just individually. And you can really start to feel you're inside what's going on in the classroom in a way that you can't when there's a massive data set and you can't get that close to it. So I think that's a big advantage. And the other reason why I think this research has an attractive quality is that if you find something that really works, well, you can say, well, look, it really works in the classroom. Why don't you try doing it? And hopefully it'll work for you as well. You can say that to teachers. It's not a sort of an indirect thing, oh, we're inferring something from something. You're saying, if teachers do this, it seems to have these effects. So those are some of the positive features, the pros, if you like, for doing this kind of research. On the other hand, there are things that are not so good about this kind of research that are problematic. One of them is the opposite of the thing to do with the size of the database. The relatively small size of the data set limits what claims can be justified about what you found. And this has been one of the attacks that some people have made of educational research. They said, oh, it's all small scale little studies, you know, it's not the real mega data like you get in educational research and like you get in medical research and similar fields. And therefore people have questioned whether the results really are robust. And to some extent that must be the case. It certainly is less convincing in some ways if you've only got a small data set. However, there are a lot of these sort of studies, and they do tend to come up with very compatible and supportive results. But nevertheless, it's an understandable concern about this kind of research. Secondly, this is an interesting one. There are problems with what's called the fidelity of the intervention. That means, are the people who are implementing your intervention actually doing what you wanted them to do? Because you've got a kind of Chinese whispers situation where you're telling somebody to do something or asking them to do it, explaining it, but then what they remember and what they interpret and how they do it may not be exactly what you mean. And certainly you can see this. Different teachers will interpret what you've asked them to do in slightly different ways. This might not matter. It might be just a matter of adapting a sort of intervention in a non-rigid way to their circumstances. But it might not just be that. It might be that they're missing something pretty crucial out. And if that happens, well, you're not really testing the intervention. You're testing something like the intervention. And that isn't nearly so good. This concern is in fact amplified by the finding that interventions tend to work best when the researchers themselves carry it out. Most research on interventional research tends to suggest that, suggesting that you have got interpretive problems when you're asking somebody else to do it. So that's a problem. It didn't seem to be a problem that causes any great concerns in the Thinking Together research, but nevertheless, it's a problem. And it's one you have to take into account if you're working in this way in schools. And thirdly, a related problem is that you can't really ensure that the teachers in the control classes aren't doing anything that's like your intervention. I mean, the intervention itself, our intervention, wasn't something we thought up in an ivory tower and said, let's get teachers to do it. It was observing what some good teachers were already doing in classrooms and refining that into a more precise form that we then asked these teachers to carry out. It wasn't as though we were asking them to do something utterly alien to what they might do. And some of the teachers of control classes might even have read some of the research or heard about it in the initial training, and we're doing something a bit similar. And you can't stop them doing it. You can't say, don't do anything useful with groups. And this is a problem. I think it's one which I've found has arisen in later projects to a greater extent. Sometimes if you tell teachers they're involved in a project and they're in the control classes, but you're going to be coming in and looking at what they're doing anyway. They think, wow, they're interested in talk, they're interested in groups. I want my classes to actually be good examples of practice. I don't want them to be seen as useless for the children. So they may well make good efforts to kind of make it as good as they can and find out how. So your comparisons aren't necessarily as extreme. In medical research, it's a lot easier. You know, you give somebody a, you know, you can give somebody an Ebola virus injection And you can give somebody a placebo injection and the difference is obvious in the consequences. But you can't do the same in educational research, and we have to take this into account. I'm going to now talk about the second project I thought I'd focus on today, which was a large-scale observational study of talk in primary classrooms. It was carried out on the basis of a grant from the ESRC, which Christine Howe, Sarah Hennessy and I gained, and it involved Maria Vricky and Lisa Withley, as it says on the slide. Our main research question was really to ask, does the quality of classroom talk really make a difference for how and what the students learn? There have been lots of relatively small scale studies of talk in classrooms, but very few larger scale ones. And in fact, this is the first really large scale observational study of talk in classrooms that's been carried out anywhere in the world. And it was carried out here in England. At the same time, in parallel, there was another large scale study of talk in primary classrooms being carried out at the University of York by Robin Alexander, Jan Hardman and Frank Hardman. But that was an interventional study, rather like the ones I described in the first part of this talk. Ours was an observational study. So what did we do? Well, as it says on the slide, we have essentially tried to recruit 80 Year 6 teachers in schools that weren't too far away from Cambridge, and which represented a range of different kinds of intake, different kind of social background of students and so on, different kinds of location. In the end, we managed to get 72 Year 6 teachers to join our project. And then we recorded two ordinary lessons in their classrooms. So this was, as I mentioned earlier, essentially an observational project. We made no intervention. We just wanted to see what was going on in those classrooms regarding talk. We, in fact, recorded three lessons in several of the classrooms, but then we discovered that you really were getting a good sample from two, so that saved time without sacrificing the quality of the data. And the teachers will be covering the normal subjects, and they all covered at least two, maths, science and English. And we then simply looked at what had gone on. Having taken account of what research, there has been a lot of research on what goes on in classrooms with talk, as you will know, even if it's not been large scale. But on the basis of that research, we had earlier with several other colleagues devised a coding scheme for making sense of what goes on in classrooms, which could be used with observational data and could be used fairly easily with large data because of the nature of the coding process. And I've put a link to the original, to a version of that scheme, which is available to you if you want to have a look at it. We modified it a bit to try and focus it on what we were interested in, but the codes reflected what researchers across the world in recent times have thought were important aspects of classroom talk when it came to the quality of education. And that meant we were looking at the sorts of things that other researchers had already identified in some ways as potentially or on the basis of their studies as useful. So you can see from the next slide the kinds of things we were focusing on, and we were looking at the level of a turn, that is, you know, one person taking over from another person in the classroom, looking at teachers. Focusing essentially on what teachers did, but obviously recording what the students did and taking that into account as in terms of what happened as a result of what the teachers said. And so you'll see some examples there of the kind of codes with obvious links to earlier research about the importance of giving children a chance to elaborate their ideas, getting them to give reasons for what they think. As I mentioned in the earlier project, the Thinking Together project, and whether they were seeking agreement, whether they were questioning ideas, and this was both the teachers and the students whose remarks recorded in this way. And in that way, we ended up with an analysis of this very large scale project's data. It makes it sound very simple. It wasn't very simple. You've got to go through lots of measures, obviously, of whether your coding is reliable and valid. And that takes some time, and it doesn't come out all that easily at first, as you perhaps know if you've been involved in that kind of research yourself. But this is essentially what we did. We counted how many of these different things were happening in the different classrooms. And then we saw whether, if more of these things happened, was that associated with students doing better or having more positive attitudes to school and so on. So the measures of attainment and attitudes we used were essentially these. We were able to use the SAT scores that children got. The schools were able to give us those scores for the children in the classes. The SATs tests, of course, being the national assessments, which all children in year six in English primary schools take at the end of that year, and which are used to grade schools in terms of how well their students are achieving. We were going to use SATs tests for English, maths and science, but although I'm not a great fan of SATs tests, it was unfortunate for us that the government withdrew the science test just before we began the project. We did in fact devise our own science test for use in the classes. But essentially these are the scores we use from SATs, and we also used a test of attitudes called PASS, which you can find out about quite easily. It's a questionnaire-based test which looks at children's attitudes to school and themselves as learners. So we were able to get this for all the classes, nearly all the classes involved. We got usable data, as you can see there. Okay then, what did we find? Well, for many of the kinds of talk we coded, we couldn't find a clear relationship between the frequency with which they happened in the classroom and the learning outcomes for the children. That wasn't perhaps so surprising. You would expect that to some extent in this kind of research. But we did get some positive results. We found that children improved significantly more in maths and English when teachers did certain things. First of all, they achieved high levels of participation in discussions. In other words, they got lots of children to join in. They didn't just ask the usual suspects who can be relied upon to provide the right answers to the class or bring in other children to get them to attend or whatever. They got lots of children to contribute to real discussions. Secondly, they encouraged children to elaborate their ideas. In other words, they weren't just content if a child said something that wasn't quite clear. They got them to expand on it, to make their thoughts public. And so the teacher really heard what the child thought, and so did the child. And thirdly, they encouraged the questioning of ideas, what we call querying in the codes. They got children to wonder about whether certain things were right or wrong. And that included, interestingly, getting them to wonder about what other children had said in discussions, and get them to think critically about what was said, and in that way to think more critically about the knowledge they were acquiring. So these things were all things that previous research had suggested might well be important for learning in classrooms, but we found that in this large-scale project that they were. And what's more, the interesting thing was we found they were only important in helping achievement, in improving attainment, when teachers did these things in combination. In other words, if a teacher achieved high levels of participation in discussions, but they never asked children to elaborate their ideas or question the ideas that were put forward, it didn't work. If they got children to elaborate, but only a few, it didn't work. It had to be a combination. And so this suggests that those things are really indicators beyond their particular nature as coded forms of talk. They're really indicating that a teacher has a certain talk climate in their classroom, which helps learning. They indicate that the teacher is really carrying out a dialogic form of education. And we also found that teachers who organised effective group work of the kind I discussed in relation to the first project, in which you heard children using exploratory talk, also helped attainment. We discovered that by the observers would focus on a couple of groups in the classroom while they were there, while the video recording was being made, and they would score those groups against the kind of criteria that I mentioned in the earlier project. And we also found that that a high frequency of elaboration in discussions was also related to positive attitudes amongst children in the school. So this was pretty good as things went. It means for the first time we got a large-scale support, a large-scale project supporting the use of dialogic teaching. And it's worth saying that there aren't any similar large-scale projects which support the non-use of dialogic teaching of a more traditional kind of setup in the classroom where the teacher doesn't really try and find out what the children think, and it's much more a straightforward question, answer and instruction kind of approach. And so this is pretty important because it provides evidence of this kind for the first time ever, really. And it means that teachers can be encouraged to be dialogic. It's probably worth saying that by this we don't mean that teachers should never provide direct instruction. We're not suggesting that at all, or that they should never ask closed questions and use IRF type interrogations to see what children really know. It's all about balance, and any people who try and kind of pit dialogic teaching against traditional teaching are really creating a false dichotomy which doesn't really count. But what this result did was show that dialogic teaching really has got empirical support. Okay, I'll just go through some positive. So that's it really from me. I've put up some references here which I hope will lead you to any of the research publications you want to follow up. And in fact, while I was doing them, it made me realise that when I was referring to the SLANT project in relation to the three kinds of talk in groups, I think I said it was carried out in the early 1980s. It was in fact the early 1990s, a decade later. But you'll find all those things there if you want to. So I hope it made sense. I hope it related to your own interest in classroom talk. And I'd be happy if you want to chase up any things that arise to you after this through questions or email or whatever. So good luck with your own work, and I hope this has been useful for you.